Thank you. So, and also thank you for the invitation to talk here. I'm going to be presenting, this is a quite new work I have been working on, that is maybe a different or alternative approach to the usual tools that you use to understand turbulence, and in particular, to understand a self-sustained mechanism in wall-bonded turbulent flows. So first, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators. So this is a project that has been going on with the help of Javier Jiménez, Gilles Tissot, or Cordier, Shang Liang. And the first iteration that we did was in the first multi-flow program in 2014. But what I'm going to be presenting here is the last version that has been going on just a few months ago in the CTR summer program, 2016.
You're not allowed to use acronyms. Nobody knows CTR.
Well, in the just in case someone doesn't know, it's the Center for Turbulent Research at Stanford. Let me just have some a little of motivation and also to set what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a turbulent channel flow and understand the self-sustaining process in the logarithmic layer. So logarithmic layer already implies a high Reynolds number. Otherwise, you don't get any logarithmic layer. So this is the configuration with the two walls, and I want to know what is happening there in that region. So the common picture is that you should be able to extract something like this. So first, there is kind of consensus that what is important is some coherent structures that are streaks and rolls somehow. So those seem to be the good players to look at. And they are related in a self-sustained process in which, well, here I'm just representing like some unknown mechanism or whatever. It's also believed that you will need some nonlinear interactions because turbulence is nonlinear, so you will need that. And then this is the linear lift-up that I just put there because apparently there seems to be a lot of consensus, like the lift-up is very, very important in this process. So basically, you look at the literature, everybody says, like, well, you have these rolls, and then these rolls, they will move the fluid up and down, and then you will generate these streaks. And apparently, this is also happening in the log layer. Then there are different approaches. So if you look at the one by Fabian, that this was done for very low Reynolds number, you can try to think about an inflectional instability that will generate traveling wave, and then you will have the feedback of the nonlinear interaction, the lift up again and coming back. There was this previous also work by Chopin Hussein. This was done in principle not for the log layer, but for the buffer layer, that is the one that you will find here very close to the wall. But still, you can assume that instead of using some molecular viscosity, you use the eddy viscosity. Maybe some of these ideas can be exported to the logarithmic layer. In this case, this is different. They were proposing a linear streak transient growth that they were laminarizing against the base flow and then getting a wavy streak that then again will generate some vortices, lift up, again coming back. Another approach is to the work proposed by Brian Farrell. This case is different. In this case, they claim that what you get is a parametric instability. That's why I have a time there in the mean velocity profile. So what is important here is that the mean velocity profile is changing in time, and because the mean velocity profile is changing in time, that is maintaining the Reynolds stresses. Then the Reynolds stresses will come back to the nonlinear iterations via torque, and again, you get the lift up is usually always there. There is even a different scenario proposed by Jiménez and Kawahara. In this case, the instability is coming from a corrugated vortex sheet. Then you get the residual disturbances, and then this is different because usually it's believed that you generate some vortices, and those vortices will survive enough such that they will generate the lift up again. So what they claim is that those vortices is not really responsible for this lift up. Those vortices cannot live long enough. They are created, they will die. And what is important is that you will have some disturbances that will remain there. And because of the mean shear interacting with those via the OR mechanism, then you will get a shear, cross shear velocity that will generate back the linear lift up. So the point for this is just to show that there are different models that are always based on some assumptions that you need to do. And then the question is, which is the one that is really happening in turbulence? And probably that is not even the good question. The question is, probably all of them are happening in turbulence because turbulence is chaotic. So the question is there a way to quantify those those dynamics, just give a real number to those. So also, when you see these arrows here, that this, somehow they imply that you have a causality flux, like this is responsible for that, and that is responsible for whatever is here, and so on. However, usually, when we study the self-sustained process, is what are the standard tools that we have? So the standard tools are like, you can do like exact coherent structure, you can have an energy budget and see which the terms, which one are contributing to the solution, or some time correlations. You can apply linear stability analysis to see what is going on, or reduce order model, or just take the DNS data and interrogate the database, or usually just a combination of all of them. So you get a theory, a linear theory, and then you go to the DNS data and try to check or to extract if that is really happening there. So these are very good, and they have been used, and I think that they should be used in the future. However, I think that to understand really what is happening in the flow, you need a real framework to cause and effect. To understand what is happening in the flow, you need a clear picture of what was the cause and what was the effect. And that can be done, indeed, with these tools. However, they are not intended to be used in that way, in the sense that there is no clear causal inference. In some of them, it's easier, for example, in linear stability, of course, you know that what is the perturbation that you use, and that is what is going to generate the rest. But then the question is that really happening on the flow? How do you know that? Because that is the linear system. It's not the real Navier-Stokes equations. So then the goal of all this is to present a new approach, a new method, to quantify the causality, and that can be done in principle to many problems, in particular to turbulence. And in particular, I'm going to apply it in the context of this workshop to the streaks and roles in the logarithmic layer. So that was the introduction and motivation. So for now, I'm going to follow this outline. I will explain what is the causality, then the numerical experiment to compute the streaks and roles, how I identify that, and then the causality flow between them. So let's move to this point, that maybe because this is a kind of new, I will spend some time here. So the question here is, imagine that you have two signals. These signals, you can think about this signal like velocities, like string-wise on vertical velocity at a given point, or just an average, so whatever, and then as a function of time. So the question is, how can I measure the causality of the signal V to the signal U? So to quantify this, there are different methods to infer causality. One is, for example, the time correlation, that I'm not saying who invented that because it's so old. But I can show an application here that was done by Jimenez. He computed time correlations in the logarithmic layer of a turbulent channel flow, and then you can see what was before and after. But it's a correlation, and we all know that in a correlation doesn't imply causality. They could be like hidden variables, so two variables that they seem to be causal one to each other. It's not because they are really connected, but because there is a third variable that will come into play there and that we don't know. Then tools that are more prepared for this are the Granger causality. So this was proposed by Granger. Indeed, he won a Nobel Prize. He was doing economics. So he took this, he applied this to the economics, and okay, it's economics, so it doesn't matter if it works or not. At the end, he got a result and he got a Nobel Prize. And if you could see really an application of this to an INTISOT at all, that's something that we did in the first summer program. But here I'm not going to use that. I'm going to use this one that I like more, that is the information flow. That this is coming from, not for a particular guy, but from information theory. And for this, you will see some report with these preliminary results that this is from the proceedings of the CTR summer program. So now what I have done is just to transfer the definition of causality to the definition of information flow. So then you have to notice that the causality is not a mathematical idea, so you really need to particularize what you mean by causality. You really need to say, this is the definition of causality, and then be happy with that and make sure that it makes sense in the context that you are applying this. So then I would say that the causality from V to the signal U is going to be equal, by definition, to the information flow from V to U. So what is the information? So this was defined by the information theory. This was started by Shannon. And the information of a variable, that you can assume that is a random variable, is equal to the minus the log of the probability distribution of the variable, following this definition. So this causality idea is indeed a statistical idea. So it's a statistical concept that applies here. And then the question of why is taking the log of that. So to take the log, I will show that later with an example. It will be much clearer. It's just so the information is additive. So if you have a change of events, the probability of those events is the multiplication of the probabilities. But then the information is the sum of all the information of all those events. So with the log is the way to get that done. For example, the very naive example, but just to have an idea. Imagine that you are flipping a coin that is fair. So you have heads and tails with 0.5. So imagine that I have a system that is just to flip the coin once. So this is a random process that I can compute the information of that event, and the information is one bit of information. So I'm using the log 2, and that's why you get the bit. And indeed, the information, it has units. So you need to define the units of this. And these units are related to the base of the log. But I'm not going to insist on that much because it's not going to be important for this, but just for you to know that this has units. For example, imagine that you flip a coin n times. So if you do that, the dynamic system of flipping that coin n times will give you n bits of information. That kind of makes sense of what you think that you get. So then you are not interested in this. You are interested in the average information in the given variable. So if you take the average of this, you know the probability of the variable, and using the definition of information, then you get the average information on a variable. And this expression looks very familiar indeed because it has the same shape as the entropy, basically. So once that I have defined the information, so this is what I mean when I say information, the question is, what is this? I'm looking for this equation. What is the equation for the rate of change of information? If I get this equation, maybe I can try to see how is the flux of information from one variable to the other. So just here some break to show you how to get that, so to see the complete process of getting this and the complete proof, you can look at Liang. So in this case, I'm just doing it for two variables, just to keep it simple. So imagine that you have this dynamic system, this 2D dynamic system, plus the Liouville equation of the dynamic system for a given that it follows this probability function that is also time dependent. So when you do that, at the end, by combining this, you can get the equation. It's indeed very simple. Just using the Liouville equation, the equation for the dynamics, and the definition of information, you get an equation. So this would be like kind of a sketch how you do that. So what is important of this equation is not the particular shape of the equation itself, but what is important here is that this equation can be rearranged in such a way that you have a term here that will that you get only because of the change of the dynamics in U, and then you will get the remaining terms. So when I got this equation here, I can just relabel this as something like this, just to make clear the meaning, is that the change of information of the variable U is going to be one term that is the self-induced change of information plus another extra term that depends on the variable B, plus imagine the case that you have more variables, then they will appear here. So this term here, that is the information flow from B to the rate of change of U, is exactly what I was looking for. So when I meant before that they want this causality from U to B, so now I have a mathematical closed expression for this. Is that a question?
Dwight Barclay, University of Oregon. So you ruled out correlation, and you invoked that could be hidden variables that we don't see, and therefore you removed that from discussion. But I don't see why there couldn't be hidden variables here. I mean, you didn't discuss any, so it looks very straightforward. But why aren't hidden variables a possibility here? How have you ruled those out in this approach? It's not clear because your little model didn't have any hidden variables.
Yeah. So, maybe it was. It's now more clear with this example. Maybe this is what. Well, I think that I will get into that, and then if it's not clear, probably we can come back to that.
Well. So Clancy Rowley from Princeton University. So V just suddenly appeared here. Where did V come from in your bottom line of this equation?
Well, V is coming from just getting the equations from here. And from using the UV equation that is will couple everything together. So the probability, you will have the probability of U condition, the probability of V condition to some events of U. And I mean, have no time to go
That's fine.
Through this. Thanks. You will have to believe me. You need to choose to believe this.
R.T. Sharma, Southampton. Your state space is continuous. So is the Shannon information the right information to use? Shouldn't you use a callback Liebler divergence from one distribution to another?
You mean because of the sample that I gave?
Your answer is going to depend how you discretize your state space, isn't it? I don't know how you do.
Well, there is no discrete time or anything here yet. I mean, this is everything is continuous up to now. So that will come later, no? Is that
state space is continuous?
Yeah. Is that?
We'll see what you do. We'll see. Okay.
I don't see how any discrete comes into play here yet until I do it. Oh, you mean this integral?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, sure. This is from in this case from minus infinity to infinity for all the possible states of U. If it's unbounded, from minus infinity to infinity. So you get this equation here, and then I argued before that this is the term that I'm looking for, but I also mentioned before that in the causality you get units. For example, I can compute this causality and get that this is like 124 bits of information transfer per whatever second. That is not clear if that is a lot, is not a lot. So for that we need to go one step forward, and this non-dimensionalize this quantity to have a reference for this quantity. So the reference for this quantity, the way I'm going to follow is the one that was defined in Liang, I want to define a normalized causality just comparing the transfer, the information flow transfer divided by the absolute value of all the terms.
Denise Gain, Johns Hopkins University. It's not clear to me that you wouldn't also have some sort of transfer from U to V.
Yes, of course.
At
you
the
have
same
an
time.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Are you looking for net transfer, or you don't care about
net
transfer?
Well, I care about all the transfer, but I'm writing the equation for one particular variable. I want to know what happens to one particular variable. And if you change the variable, then just relabel all the indices in my equation.
I guess my question is, if you have transfer from V to U and U to V, and you're trying to figure out causality, if you have, say, a bigger transfer from V to U versus U to V, your causality, your idea of what's causal might change.
Well, you mean, well, I don't know if you are talking about the way of non-dimensionalizing the causality with respect to how the information flow is from one to the other or something like that.
She thinks it's not enough to look at tau.
Lorette Tuckerman.
Yeah, sorry, Lorette Tuckerman. ESPCI. She thinks it's not enough to look at tau v to u, but to also look at tau u to v that would occur in the v equation.
Yeah, it will happen in the v equation. Wait. That is.
But yes, so continue then, and I think we'll stop the questions for a little while.
Okay. Okay, so I just decided to denormalize this in this way. So this, the information transfer from V to U, and of course you will have an equivalent from U to V that will follow the same kind of the same equation, just changing the variables. It's going to be normalized by this, and what is nice about this is that this is a value that is bounded between 0 and 1. So then it's very intuitive. If something is 0, it means that V has nothing to do with U, absolutely nothing to do. If it's 1, it will imply that it's fully causal to you. And then related to correlation, for example, imagine this, so this would be like a proven theorem when you follow this approach. Imagine that you have a dynamic system in which this is set to 0. The variable, it doesn't enter into the equation. So if the variable doesn't enter into the equation, by construction, the causality from V to U is going to be 0. that is something kind of intuitive that you will think. Even if there is an influence through a third variable, that could happen. Could happen that V will influence W, and W is in this is here, but doesn't matter, it's zero. Okay, so this is the definition that I want to use, and now here is probably one of the main drawbacks of this, is that I have shown that they have an analytic expression for all this term, so everything is closed, everything is known, everything can be computed, but it's extremely expensive when you go to a...
How do you compute the probability distribution? Yeah, analytic expression over probability. Oh. John Gibson, University of New Hampshire. How do you have an analytic expression for the probability density function of a variable of, you know, centerline velocity of a fluid in a pipe or something?
Yeah. So what you need to do is to have a set of infinite number of experiments.
They will okay.
An infinite set of experiments that you will start from some initial condition, and then they will evolve, and they will have the probability distribution, and the gotcha. Dynamics are known, and then you can evaluate this. That is obviously impossible. You will need to run an infinite number of DNS or a very large number to converge everything. Well, even if you want to get reasonably converged statistics, this is going to be very expensive for a system with a lot of degrees of freedom. For example, if you want to consider the Lorentz equation, you can do it. That is feasible. You can do it in a laptop. It's not so bad. Or maybe a system with 2 or 3 degrees of freedom, that's okay, you can do it. I'm talking about system with 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 degrees of freedom. That cannot do it. So for that, you need a simplification. And instead of computing this, we need to compute an estimator for this. And to compute that, I'm going to assume that I only know the signals as a function of time. I don't know the equation. The equation could be also be very complicated to get. You need to assume ergodicity also in turbulence. You will also assume that you have some kind of dynamic model for the variables to develop for some time, for a short time, and then a Gaussian distribution of variables that, of course, most of these points are not very well satisfied always in turbulence. But if you do that, and then the proof how to get that is in the end 2014, then you can get an expression that it depends on kind of the correlation between the variables, not only the correlation between the variables, but also correlation that will imply derivatives of velocity. But I think that the bottom line here is that you can get an expression that now you can compute in a laptop. Yes. So before it was something impossible to compute, then despite all these simplifications that many of them I feel very bad, like I don't want to do this. But if you do that, then you can get an expression that is very, very cheap. So you pay this price, but then the output that you get is also very, very good. So now this is very simple to compute. Anyone can compute this, given the signals. I don't even need to know the dynamics. If I have some data from whatever, the atmosphere of Mars or whatever, I can just put this here, or some variables that I don't know where they're coming from. So this expression that is a simplification has been tested in some nonlinear systems with low degrees of freedom, and it seems to work okay. Not really sure of how good it is for a high dimensional system, but yeah, we are working on trying to validate this, how good it is. But for now, I will stick to this. So now the numerical experiment. So this is going to be very fast. It's very simple. It's just the turbulent channel flow. You have the mean velocity. This is, I'm coming from the doing DNS of turbulent channel flows, so I like to have Reynolds number are reasonably high, although this one is, to me, will look like very moderate, but for now it's okay. So what I'm computing is a minimal channel flow in the sense that these sizes are selected such that I have just a few structures in the log layer, because I want to understand the log layer, really. So these are the numerics and the resolution are very important. So what I have done is to run this for 140 editune over times. These are based on the half height of the channel and the friction velocity. This is a long time, so then I have a good sample of all the possible states of the system. And then it's also time resolved because I'll need to compute the time derivatives for the causality. So this is just to show you. So what I'm doing is taking a plane that is a distant 0.25 h. And to take that plane is justified, and for that you can look at Flores and Jimenez. If you have a channel of this size and you take a plane here, you are restricting to just one structure in the logarithmic layer, plus all the small things. But the small things I will remove later. So this is, I'm going to define, this is going to be the, my U, string-wise. The wall normal, I'm going to call it V. And the span-wise, I'm going to call it W. And then X, Y, and Z, as is usually done. So let me. Maybe it freeze. Maybe. Okay. Now, so identifications of role and streak. So I will have to hurry a little. So for now, for this. So what I'm going to show now is kind of some the preliminary results, because this is the first time we have done that. So for now, the streaks, what we have done is just to take the POD modes, the first POD modes of the velocity and that given plane. And then I want to define like two streaks of two states for the streak, like mode zero, the streak is straight. And then a meandering streak, that is the other mode. Of course, these modes will appear in pairs, and then you have to take that into account because of the symmetry of the flow and all that. So, okay, now what I want to do, what I'm doing now is defining what are going to be the signals that I need. So when you do the proper orthogonal decomposition, I can get a signal for this mode, and I can get another signal for this other mode. So that is one of the two signals I'm going to use. Now, this was for the streaks, this the string-wise velocity at that plane. So now I'm going to do the same for the rolls. I'm calling these the rolls, although I'm just looking at the velocities separately, like V and W, so just repeating the same process. So P of V. And for now, I'm just keeping these two modes to see what happens. And so I'm naming this as long vertical velocity and short, just so to have some intuitive idea of what is happening. This is the same for the W, like long W and short W. So these are the signals that I want to compute the causality between these different states in the flow. So now let's move to that. So these are the different states that I have, that I organize here. So what I'm going to do is to have like some connections, and I'm going to use like solid for a strong causality, and then a dash for weak causality. So how do I get the causality? So they compute a causality map that it will look like something like this. Imagine this is the causality map of the streaks to the vertical velocity. So the way to read this, so here I have the streaks, here I have vertical velocity. The way to read this is, you have a meandering streak, so the causality is going from that streak to this velocity. And the intensity of that causality is measured by this number here. So meandering streaks will be responsible for getting a short velocity, so then I can make the connection there. Okay? So then this is the other one. So then causalities that are very low, like these two, below 1% in this range, they are not going to take those into account. Sometimes they are very, very close to zero, like this that you get here. Like a meandering streak is not able to get a long velocity. That kind of makes sense. If the streak is meandering, how is that going to create a long velocity? Well, now we will repeat with the causality from the streaks to the W, and these are weaker, so you use the dashed lines. And now the ones remaining are from these velocities to the streaks. So I'm going to put everything here now. And then I'm missing a few in between these, but just for clarity and for the sake of time, I'm not going to show those. So now let's try to put the numbers here, because I said at the beginning that part of the beauty of all this is that you can really compute a number that is between zero, that's fully non-causal, or one that is fully causal. So that's part of what is interesting here to quantify this. So then you get this, and we can look at some of these interactions. For example, imagine this. So this is having this mode that is like a roll, a span-wise roll, and the streak, and you see that these causalities are like weak. Well, in general, something that I didn't mention is that this number, if you look for the largest one, is this one, that is like 0.5. And that is the strongest one, but I don't expect this to be very close to one, because if you get something that is one, it will imply that that variable is always responsible for the causality of the other at all times, because this is an average, and I don't expect that to happen all time. So for a period of time, you will get some causality. So that is my explanation of why this number, they never get above that. So this case, you can understand, like, okay, you have some unimportant span weight role, probably because the causality is weak in this sense. So that would be one interpretation. Let's look at this, for example. So this maybe could be a lift up, like you have some vertical velocity, and then you will generate a straight streak, something like that. Then let's look at, for example, this one. So this one is like you get some straight streak, it's the opposite, and then you will get a long velocity. And the way I'm labeling this is like nonlinear effect by pressure, because when you write the equation for this, you will see that the only term in which a mode like this comes into play is through continuity in the pressure. So you can add that into the pressure. So this would be like kind of interpretation, the nonlinear effect. Now, for example, let's look at how this meandering streak is created. So you have several effects. So you have effects for this that I also mentioned before. But so this is kind of the span with velocity creating the streak. But if you look at these numbers, apparently this is not very important. Or this seems to mention that span with velocities are not very important to get the meandering streak. However, what seems to be much more important is to have this short velocity. So I'm labeling this like low desestabilization effect of W in the streak. And this could be still that the lift up is playing a role still to maintain this streak, or some nonlinear effect. And well, the last one is just like a breakdown of the streak. So the breakdown will get like a short velocity that kind of vortices like structure. So at the end, what I think is important of all this is is that you can really go to real turbulent data. So now I will move to the conclusions and just spend 1 minute here. So I think that what is remarkable here is that you can really look at into real turbulent data, because I'm really using a DNS simulation, and then get a number for a different process and try to relate, like this I think is the lift up, this I think is some nonlinear effect. And so this is what is the beauty of this tool. So this tool is different from the most common tools used in turbulence. You can measure that causality, and is that data-driven, so you can use a DNS flow. Still, you need the other approximation to understand the flow. I mean, this itself is telling you nothing. Then you need to interpret everything in the context of linear theory or whatever, but this is really happening. And then I have applied this to the self-sustaining process in the log layer, and then once that you define these roles and streaks, that I don't mean this is the best way of doing it, it's just a simple way that I did it using a POD, yes, then at least you can try to go interaction by interaction and try to relate all of them with the known mechanism that you find. And that's it. Thank you.
Roman Grigoriev, Georgia Tech. So,
I should say this a long time ago. People are mumbling when they say their names and their institutions, so say it clearly again.
Roman Grigoriev, Georgia Tech.
All right.
We'll work on that, okay. General question. Mm-hmm. In order to make the computational cost low, you, as far as I understand, you're using a linearized model, correct?
I'm assuming that the dynamics are linear for a time. That's one of the...
Then there is a very straightforward and very mathematically well-defined method to determine causality, which is based on Tichmarsh theorem. Why go into very complicated math, which involves lots of assumptions, if there is a much more straightforward method?
Well, this method this has a very nice and beautiful properties that you can list, like it has been very well tested already in very simple non-dynamical systems. You have the property of what is called the nil causality, that you will get zero if in the dynamic system you don't get nothing. I don't mean this is best. It's not complicated, indeed. It's very simple once you get that. Once that you get the formulation, that was the point, was that it's very easy. It's done in a laptop. So it's not complicated. It's simple. Maybe the way of derivation is more messy, but of course, there is an alternative method, also the Granger causality, and it also works. It also can be applied. We have done it. We get similar conclusions, and yeah.
Seems like the kind of kind of questions cannot quite be answered.
Mike Graham, Wisconsin. Using my teacher voice. So I guess I have a related question to the previous one. You talked about the information flows in terms of a model there. You had an evolution equation, and you can get an evolution equation, and you have terms that give these information flows. So what was the evolution equation that used it as a model here for the interaction between the POD modes? Is that a linear stochastic model? Is that what?
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Apparently you don't like much the part of the linear model. So
I just wanted, it was a little unclear.
I don't like the linear model personally. That's why I also emphasize that you pay a high price and then you get a very simple expression. So what we have been doing is not using that linear model, but just testing different models. For example, in turbulence, we know that there are better ways of representing the dynamics of the turbulent flow. For example, I can use dynamic mode decomposition. And that has been shown to capture like transient growth events and turbulence. So instead of using that linear model,
It's also a linear model.
You're right. But if you want to get a simple expression, you need to stick to that. Otherwise, you cannot. But it's a linear model that is probably more suitable for turbulent flows. So we will try to that and see if that is making any difference. For example.
And Carlo.
So it's Carlo Conso from CNRS IMFT France. So I have a question about okay, you make some assumption, but the question after you make it, for instance, imagine you have a periodic solution, no? And then you do the POD or whatever you want of a periodic, you know, self-sustained process. In that case, would you have one, you know, on all the transfer of information, or would you get something else in that case?
Is that depending on how you decompose the flow in modes?
Yeah, but imagine that I take another stock solution which is periodic in time, no?
Well,
so everybody
no.
should
this
be completely
is, this is
correlated
a statistical approach.
And causality
that's deterministic. You won't apply this in that case.
Yeah, but you talk about a self-sustained process in the log layer. Imagine that one exists.
Yeah.
And then you have some noise on top just to blur the picture. But imagine that which is probably not right, but imagine that you have that. With this approach, can you detect it or not?
Maybe. I don't know. Okay. Maybe. I'm afraid is that if the process is totally deterministic and you don't have a spread of solutions to kind of average if that is what is going to happen there.
Okay.
Could be.
RT Sharma, Southampton. I really like the idea. I'm still stuck on the details of how you calculate this entropy, where P comes from, and how you discretize the state space to get a Shannon entropy. Could you maybe give a bit more detail there?
Yeah, so when I go to the... You mean to the equations? Kind of here to get the so there are two different parts that are separated. Okay, one is the continuous system in which you assume that you know everything there, so there is no discretization of anything, and then you have an equation that is closed. So that's what is nice of this, that you get something that is closed and you can understand what is the effect of all the terms that you get there. But then there is no discretization yet here because, as I mentioned, that would be very expensive. You just would need to run a DNS. Well, like infinite number of DNS, let's say. Then you already discretize the dynamics, and then you will have a probability distribution, for example, of vertical velocities that will span, in principle, from minus infinite to infinite, although in the practice you will get a bounded domain. And then that's it. That's the integration that will come into that. However, this is not what we are using. We use just after all those simplifications that are very strong, then you just get the kind of correlation between variables. So the only thing that you need is to discretize in time fine enough so you are able to represent the derivatives of those variables. If you are accurate on the derivatives of those variables, then you are fine. And indeed, it's something that you should always check, you know, refine in time, and then check that everything remains the same.
Joe Klawicki, University of New Hampshire. Could you go to your correlation equation, the one that you actually used? This is a simple question. Does this still have the same bounds, 0 and 1, as the original one?
Well, this is just the transfer for the variables v to u. So that's a correlation, no?
Yeah. Between the cross correlation. You describe that tau, the information flow from v to u. Previously, you gave it a bound either 0 or 1.
Yeah, that's one.
Do these correlations still have those same bounds?
Well, the one that has that bound is the expression above, no? It's the one that you will make sure that is between 0 and 1.
And this one? What about this one?
And this one,
that's the one.
I don't think so, no? Because you have this cross correlation UV there in the denominator, and I don't know what it's exactly doing. That would change the variable. I don't think so. I don't think it's bounded between 0 and 1.
Okay, I guess I'll ask. So I'm following up on Ati's question. This is Clancy Rowley from Princeton. Could you go back to the equation that you were showing, Ati, just maybe one slide, I think? One more, yeah. Yeah, that one. So I'm still not understanding what in that bottom equation is known and what you're trying to solve for. For instance,
everything
it seems to me
known.
That conditional probability of P of V given U, yeah. That's really what you want to solve for, right?
No, I just want to evaluate this expression.
Given data.
I want to evaluate the terms in this expression.
So
and if,
what
if,
do
if you put
know
in a
beforehand?
Effort, everything is known.
So do you know little p of u? Do you know capital P of V given
if,
u?
If you have the solution for an infinite number of dynamic systems, then you know everything, yeah? You know the joint probability and you can compute conditional probability or whatever you want to.
Do you at least know capital F?
Yeah, those are Navier-Stokes.
You do know capital F?
Yeah.
And you're trying to solve for little p of u and capital
no,
P
no,
of
no,
v.
I'm not trying to solve. I'm just trying to evaluate.
Maybe you mean different things?
Perhaps. Okay, so you... Right, so you're trying to... Am I correct that you're trying to figure out what capital P of V given U is? That's the main thing you're trying to
Which capital
figure
what?
Out?
The conditional probability. Doesn't that correspond to tau of...
That's my question. Is that what you're trying to solve for in this formula?
No.
Trying to figure out from your data?
That's given.
I guess that's what I'm confused about.
If you run the DNS cases, then you compute that P, and then you compute that F, and then you get everything.
Okay, but you're
so
saying
what,
you compute it from the data. So you figure it out from the data.
Or if you know the analytic solution, then you put it there. It's not that it's unknown in any sense. It's like, it's from the practical point of view, it's very expensive.
I guess the question when you say you compute it, is that then why?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
So when you say that you compute
microphone. Microphone.
Denise Game, Johns Hopkins University. I just want to clarify. So when you say that's what you compute, you mean you're going to then plot that as the information to tell you your T, U to V.
Yeah.
So it is essentially P, V dot, slash U that you're going to plot later?
Well, because... To get that P, I need a huge amount of data that I could get. That's why later I need some assumptions to simplify this expression.
But it's an approximation for that expression.
It's an approximation. This is exact.
Okay.
Then later it's an approximation.
Tom, I think maybe that's the last question. Yeah.
Okay, Colm Caulfield, University of Cambridge. Oh, and we just lost your presentation. So. Could you go to a couple of slides on the normalized thing we were looking at? So imagine many of the questions have focused on whether you can work this out or not. But what I'm interested in is its utility. Imagine it works. And I could imagine that I'd know a U that I was interested in, a variable and an observable that I was interested in what was causing that U. But I could
there's an infinity of V's that I could choose to test. And since you're talking about a normalized quantity, there's two different situations. The tau could be large, but di self could be large, and yet the tau could be small, yet di self dt is very small, and so this normalized causality is one. How would I choose what was actually the right thing? If there was a lot of tau dependence of V1 to U, but still the normalized quantity was 0.4, whereas another one where tau was a very, V2 was very small, yet the normalized quantity was 1, what was 0.45, would that be better or worse? I don't actually see the ultimate utility of this process, because there's an infinity of V's I could choose. How do you choose the V you're going to choose see what it depends on?
Well, but that is not a problem of V's. It's a problem of physics in general, no? Like, what are the relevant quantities? Is that what you are asking for? Because this is not going to solve that problem.
I would like to know a process to identify those relevant quantities rather than...
You need to have a priori knowledge, as always, in the physics. I decided to choose a V and U and define some POD modes. Maybe those are absolutely not relevant or significant for the system. Indeed, that is one of the most difficult parts of all this. That is independent of the method. Of the method is, I'm going to look at what is relevant. What are the relevant participants here? Is that the U and V? Maybe not. You get a causality anyway, but maybe you need to.
But I guess. But then there is the issue of normalized causality. Is it better to look at where the normalized causality is close to one, or the tau is very large, or in magnitude?
Well, both are different. One is a relative quantity. You can look at both if you want to. One has units. It's like, what is important: the energy that you get, the transfer of energy, or a normalized transfer of energy? So both are different.
Okay. Well, thank you, and I think we'll continue.